were concerned that the repeal, the Affordable Health Care Act, not also repeal the Indian Health Care Act.
Alaska tribes worry about health care funding stability under President Donald Trump. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Thursday, January 26th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, a student is arrested for threatening a school shooting on Twitter.
The student was taken into custody and remanded to FCC under the charge of terroristic threatening.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by
the 2017 statewide BP Teachers of Excellence program. Teacher nomination forms available at bpteachers.com.
January 31st is the last day to enroll in the health insurance marketplace. For assistance in your area, go to getcoveredalaska.org or call 1-844-PLANS-AK. This message sponsored by Alaska Primary Care Association.
Planned Parenthood is praising U.S. Senator Lisa Murkowski for signing onto a bill that would permanently repeal what's known as the Global Gag Rule or the Mexico City Policy. The rule bans federal money for overseas family planning programs if the programs also provide abortion or provide information about abortion. President Trump recently signed an order to reinstate the rule. This week, more than 40 U.S. senators have sponsored a bill to overturn the so-called gag rule. Senator Murkowski says the bill ensures the U.S. won't discriminate against international organizations that counsel women about their reproductive health options, but would not allow spending federal funds to perform abortions. In a written statement, the senator says the gag rule undermines America's standing abroad. Murkowski's voting record on abortion is uneven, but she is one of the few Senate Republicans who often adopts positions that favor abortion rights. President Donald Trump angered many Native activists by moving to restart Dakota Access Pipeline construction. Thousands have protested the line, saying it could poison the Standing Rock Sioux's water supply. They also see the move as an affront to tribal sovereignty. But before Trump's inauguration, his transition team met with Native leaders to ask what they wanted out of the new administration. Coast Alaska's Ed Schoenfeld reports.
The meetings were billed as listening sessions with Trump's Native American coalition and included members of the president's transition team. The coalition, formed just before November's election, is chaired by Republican U.S. Representative Mark Wayne Mullen, a member of the Cherokee Nation of Oklahoma. Jacqueline Peta of the Juneau-based Central Council of Tlingit and Haida Indian Tribes of Alaska was among those at the Western meeting. She's executive director of the National Council of American Indians and a board member of Sea Alaska, Southeast's regional Native corporation.
There are things in this administration's agenda that we can find common ground on, like infrastructure development, like improving the economies of our communities. But tribal leaders made it really clear tribes are governments and should be treated as such and respected as such.
She said tribal leaders brought up health care, government contracting, education, and resource extraction. That included opposition to the Dakota Access Pipeline.
Tribal leaders said things like, we're not opposed to development, but we want to be able to make sure that we have a meaningful place and that our consent is part of the process of evaluating the permits that may affect our lands.
Tlingit Haida Central Council's Will Micklin, who also attended the meeting, said an overriding issue was the future of Obamacare.
We're concerned that the repeal, the Affordable Health Care Act, not also repeal the Indian Health Care Act, and not reduce funding for it from our other funding sources.
Another issue brought up in the meetings was land into trust. That program allows tribal governments to transfer title to the federal government, which protects the land from taxation or seizure. Alaska Native tribes have just begun using the program. Mark Trahant is a former University of Alaska journalism professor and a blogger on Native issues. He's a member of the Shoshone-Bannock tribe, now teaching at the University of North Dakota.
That was kind of evolving late in the Obama administration, and now organizations and tribes want to follow through. They're going to need some sort of mechanical side to make the process work. And whether or not resources are put into that by the administration, I think will be interesting to see.
Changes in the state's far north are also being watched by some Alaska Native leaders. Trey Hant worries the new administration doesn't know much about it beyond the potential for oil and gas production. That's especially since Trump and members of his administration question the human role in climate change.
Even thinking about the United States as an Arctic nation and when a changing Arctic nation, and what does that mean and what are the policy implications? The Obama administration had pushed very hard on the environmental side of that, but now you may see things like more interest in shipping lanes and resource extraction and that sort of Arctic issues.
While those attending the Trump team's Native Coalition meetings were encouraged by the interest, they know many of their concerns don't mesh with the new administration's goals. That's certainly the case with the Dakota Pipeline. I'm Ed Schoenfeld, reporting in Juneau.
Bogoslav volcano has erupted again, sending a cloud of ash and ice particles 30,000 feet into the air. The Alaska Volcano Observatory says the cloud was seen by satellite shortly after the eruption today. Volcanic ash above 20,000 feet is a threat to airliners flying between Asia and North America. The aviation color code remains at red, the highest warning level. The volcano, 850 miles southwest of Anchorage, has erupted more than 25 times since mid-December. Seismic activity returned to low levels after the eruption today. A Fairbanks student is charged with terroristic threatening due to a social media post. Fairbanks North Star Borough School District spokeswoman Cherise Walker says staff at West Valley High School were alerted this morning to the threat posted on a student's Twitter account.
So administration, they located the student, placed the school into a sit-tight mode, conducted a search on the student and the student's vehicle, contacted troopers.
State Troopers spokeswoman Megan Peters says the student, identified as 19-year-old Nicholas Palacio, posted about shooting classmates.
Troopers did go to the school and make contact with the student, and there was no possession of any firearm during the incident or anything like that. The student was taken into custody and remanded to FCC under the charge of terroristic threatening in the second degree.
Peters says troopers are not aware of any continued threat. Peters adds troopers were flooded with calls from West Valley parents asking if they should pick their kids up. The school district says parents were notified about what happened, but the school day continued as normal following a 20-minute sit-tight. The man suspected of the shooting at a South Florida airport that left five people dead and six wounded has been formally indicted by a federal grand jury. The indictment, returned today, charges 26-year-old Esteban Santiago with 11 counts of causing death or bodily harm at an international airport, five counts of causing death during a crime of violence, and six counts of using a firearm during a crime of violence. Santiago could face the death penalty if convicted in the January 6th shooting at Fort Lauderdale-Hollywood International Airport. The indictment contains no terrorism-related charges, despite Santiago's claims to the FBI that he was inspired by the Islamic State extremist group. Santiago is scheduled to enter a plea to the charges Monday. He's being held without bail. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a look at the good and bad of South Central's weather.
We're expecting a bunch of natural avalanche activity.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
If you're a rural Alaska resident, consider applying for a seat on the Federal Subsistence Regional Advisory Council by Friday, February 3, 2017. Applicants with knowledge of regional subsistence uses, customs, and traditions are needed. Council meetings serve as a forum for subsistence management. More at 1-800-478-1456. This message sponsored by your Federal Subsistence Board and the U.S. Departments of the Interior and Agriculture.
A warm weather front in South Central Alaska is expected to dissipate tonight, making way for cooler weather over the weekend. National Weather Service meteorologist Jason Ossenmacher says it will be a gradual shift over the next few days.
What that means for areas like Seward, all the way up through Anchorage, is that we're going to be seeing, we're going to be cooling back down again on Saturday. It's not going to get cold, but it's going to be cooling back down towards normal. But we will be seeing increasing snow chances by Saturday.
Hassenmacher says strong winds down Turnagain Arm should also taper off. Last weekend's heavy snow, followed by warmer temperatures and rain, cultivated treacherous avalanche conditions in the mountains. Heather Thaim with the Chugach National Forest Avalanche Information Center says a backcountry avalanche warning has been issued for the area, urging skiers, snowboarders, and snow machiners to avoid avalanche terrain.
We're expecting a bunch of natural avalanche activity, and this activity could be fast-moving and run far in a lot of the paths.
Thaim says the possibility of human-triggered avalanches will remain likely throughout the weekend. The State Department of Transportation conducted avalanche mitigation today along the Seward Highway from Byrd to Portage. Thaim observed some of the artificially triggered avalanches.
We've already seen a couple big slides come down to the bike path zone. So they are running the full length of their paths right now, at least in this steep channel terrain.
Thaim says avalanche conditions are high throughout much of the Kenai Peninsula, including the Girdwood Valley, Turnagain Pass, and the Seward area. Road conditions are expected to deteriorate tonight as wet roads begin to freeze up amid cooling temperatures throughout South Central. The ingredients for picture-perfect snowflakes came together in South Central Alaska this past weekend. Brian Brettschneider is a climatologist in Anchorage who closely tracks Alaska climate data and trends. Alaska's Energy Desk is checking in with him regularly as part of the segment Ask a Climatologist. He told Energy Desk editor Annie Feit the snowflakes that fell in South Central last weekend were especially large and piled up quickly.
There's a couple of ways you can get big snowflakes. You can have really wet snow where the flakes clump together, but then when that falls, it really compresses. But we had a situation where the whole thermal profile of the lowest, say, 10,000 feet of the atmosphere was right in a sweet spot to promote large snowflake growth, and that's called the dendritic growth zone. And it lets the arms, if you will, of the snowflakes get really, really big, and that traps lots of air in it. So it's kind of light, low-density, fluffy snow that really piles up quickly.
Did you actually, look at some of these flakes to see how long the arms were?
Well, not necessarily under a microscope, but you could definitely tell they were big flakes. And when you melt it all out, normally a typical snowfall, there's a ratio of about 12 inches of snow would equal 1 inch of melted water. In this case, at the Anchorage National Weather Service office, it actually translated to about 25 or 30 to 1 was the ratio. So very, very dry, light snow that piles up quickly. But as eventually as it gets compressed down with more snow and as those dendrites break off the snowflakes, it compresses quite a bit. So we've already lost, as far as the depth, already about half of that snowfall.
Do different parts of the state, are they more likely to get one type of snow or the other?
The farther north you go, where it's really, really cold, Fairbanks and northward, typically the atmospheric profile is too cold to promote that large growth. So usually you don't get those kind of big dry snowflake ratios. And then down in southeast, usually it's warmer. And so it's more common to get the wet snow that clumps together, but it doesn't pile up as much. But really anywhere in the state at different times of the year, it could certainly happen.
Do you have a favorite type of snow?
I think most people, especially if you have to shovel a driveway, appreciate the lighter, fluffier snow that's easier to move around and doesn't cause as many aches and pains.
Brian Brettschneider is a climatologist who lives in Anchorage. He spoke with Annie Feit from Alaska's Energy Desk as part of a regular look at climate change in the state. A new tsunami survival option has come to the Pacific coast. It involves climbing into a spherical aluminum pod for what is sure to be the ride of your life. Northwest News Network correspondent Tom Bonsi reports from Ocean Park, Washington, where he spoke with the first U.S. buyer of this technology.
Jeannie Johnson just recently moved from the Seattle area to what she calls her dream home at the beach. It's about midway up the sandy, flat Long Beach Peninsula.
When I decided to move to the ocean, into a tsunami zone, I felt like I should prepare.
Her tsunami evacuation options are not good. She could make a run for it, but this Microsoft executive doubts she could reach the distant high ground in the short time between the end of the shaking of a great earthquake and incoming tsunami waves.
People panic, and I don't want to be caught in the panic.
A bit of internet research led her to a new option, a bright orange, high-strength, floating metal ball. She's taken delivery and is now deciding whether to tether her capsule in her herb garden or keep it in the garage. In any case, Johnson wants her dog to join her if and when the big one comes.
Trixie, hop. Come on, baby. Hop. Let's go. Let's go. Hop. Good girl.
My model is big enough for two people to be buckled in like a pilot seat.
So that you're going to get into this sphere.
Yeah.
And it's looks to me a little bit like an astronaut capsule, actually.
It does. It looks a little bit like it came from NASA.
The aircraft-grade aluminum sphere is about 4.5 feet in diameter. It has a round marine door and two tiny portholes.
And I have friends who say, oh my God, wouldn't it be claustrophobic? How can you stand it? And all I can think is, what's my option? To drown. I would rather be in that ball for the ride of my life and maintain my life.
Johnson is the first domestic customer of a startup called Survival Capsule, based near Seattle. Company president Julian Sharp says he got the idea for the product lying awake one night while weekending in Cannon Beach, Oregon.
I thought, well, what happens now if a tsunami comes?
The aerospace engineer had a brainstorm.
And I just thought, well, it's going to be a disaster because I've got 4 sleeping kids. If it comes at night, lights are going to be out. You know, you don't necessarily know where you're going. You can't see the wave, how far it is. So I thought it would be great if I had something I could design, throw the family in and ride it out. And that's where it all started.
Sharp's company's initial sales have been to Japanese customers. 8 capsule kits so far. He anticipates local governments in Japan could become a major customer base, along with private sales along the U.S. West Coast, Gulf Coast, and East Coast.
The target customer is the person who lives on the ocean who cannot vertically or horizontally evacuate.
That's potentially a lot of people, as long as they're willing to pay the price. Sharp says the 2-person survival capsule starts at $13,500. A 4-person model lists for $17,500. Residents who swung by Long Beach City Hall earlier to look at plans for a different evacuation option had mixed reactions to the tsunami capsule idea. Jane Benna shivers at the prospect of sheltering inside while being battered by tsunami debris.
I would hate to be bounced around in that. I'm too old. I'm 80 years old. I don't know that I would care to survive a tsunami.
The city of Long Beach, Washington is using grant money to design an armored man-made hill that could be used as a tsunami evacuation platform for at least 850 people. Benna favors building that, but as you maybe can tell, she's fatalistic about her own chances. I'm Tom Bonsi on the Long Beach Peninsula.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Artists, show us how you inspire Alaska. Apply now for an individual artist award. Deadline is March 1st. Learn more at rasmussen.org/IAA. This message sponsored by Rasmussen Foundation.
As it turns out, you don't need to wear a cape to save the community or a giant S on your chest to stand up for what's right. That's because the University of Alaska is working to build a better future for our state. Through education, the university is developing a skilled workforce with more teachers, engineers, and nurses to move Alaska forward. Join the university in leading the change Alaska needs. Visit drivechangeak.org to learn more. This message sponsored by the University of Alaska.
Officials with the State Department of Environmental Conservation and a Fairbanks-based trucking company are still assessing the extent of a recent fuel spill along the Richardson Highway south of Paxson. As KUAC's Tim Ellis reports, officials with the Alaska Department of Environmental Conservation say diesel from a Colville transport tanker crash appears to have seeped into the roadbed.
DEC officials say workers with Colville Transport and its cleanup contractor have removed less than 500 gallons of diesel fuel from an area along the Richardson Highway near Myers Lake, where the Colville tanker truck crashed January 10th, spilling 4,329 gallons of diesel. But DEC officials believe most of the diesel soaked into the roadbed itself and the ground below.
Right now we're looking at just figuring out the complete impact areas.
Ashley Adamczak is an environmental program specialist with the DEC's Fairbanks office. Adamczak says the Federal Bureau of Land Management has approved the state's request to excavate contaminated material from the land BLM administers alongside that stretch of the highway. And she says the State Department of Transportation is okay to request to remove tainted material from its right-of-way, but she says the DEC wants more information before giving the go-ahead for either operation. DEC officials say it's been tough to get much done over the past couple of weeks due to a lack of space to operate around that narrow, hilly stretch of the highway, and because of heavy snow, cold weather, and traffic related to the Copper Basin 300 sled dog race. Adamczak says any excavation of the roadway itself probably won't be done until warmer weather arrives.
We would not do any excavation within the DOT right-of-way until the summer, where we don't have to worry about causing a hazard along the road.
In Fairbanks, I'm Tim Ellis.
During the 1970s, a small number of tough-minded young people moved into what is now the Yukon-Charlie River's National Preserve. They built cabins, trapped, fished, hunted, and raised sled dogs, living a version of the Alaskan dream that would soon become a thing of the past. The third section of John McPhee's book, Coming Into the Country, profiles many of these people, living a life only the Alaskan frontier could offer. Elizabeth Harbaugh spoke with one man McPhee wrote about in this section of the book, and the woman who completes his story.
This is a love story. It was first written in a journal in 1975, tacked to the wall of an empty cabin and left in one of the wildest parts of Alaska.
Monday, November 10th, minus 12 degrees, cloudy and May snow. Today is the anniversary of being in Alaska for exactly 1 year now.
Rich Karaz's story might have stayed in the abandoned cabin forever, but some months later, writer John McPhee wandered in and found the journal. McPhee was taken by this tale of survival, addressed in parts to a girl named Sarah. He included excerpts like this one in his book, Coming Into the Country.
Quite a lot has happened, and if I had Sarah now, it would be the end of a near-perfect year. Still, it was the best decision I ever made, and I'm very glad things worked out. If I was religious, I might say, thank you, Lord. Amen.
Rich spent his first winter in the Alaska wilderness in 1975 when he was just 23. He had been working as a logger in the forests of Wyoming and Colorado, but he felt constricted. He drove north to Montana, and within days, he decided there were too many people there, too. In the book, McPhee quotes Rich saying he settled on the Alaska bush because there ain't no barbed wire up here. Rich says that sums it up.
Oh, that was so good. That was so good. A lot of things he said in one line, I could waste a lot of words on, but he said it right. And yeah, it was totally open country. There was no barbed wire, none. And I loved it. It was made for me, you know.
Although Alaska was everything Rich hoped for, a girl he'd left behind in the lower 48 occupied his thoughts. In his journal, Rich punctuated his accounts of grouse hunting and chopping wood with heartsick notes like, good night, Sarah, good morning, Sarah, and Sarah, where are you? It's been 40 years since these words ended up in the pages of Coming Into the Country. Even though he gave McPhee permission to publish the journal, Rich is still a little shy about it.
I was kind of shocked that he wrote the love story part of it.
It's a bit awkward to talk about today, because as he's reading from his old journal, Rich is next to the woman he spent his life with. And her name's not Sarah, it's Sonia.
Sonia was the first girl I met in Alaska.
But we weren't at all impressed with each other.
At the time, Sonia Woodman Karaza was also living in the Upper Yukon. Sonia was born on Alaska's Kenai Peninsula and grew up fishing. But Sonia was also drawn to the bush, and in 1975, she was living with a friend in a cabin about 40 miles from Rich. Sonia and Rich kept running into each other and helping each other out.
You know, when I had my chainsaw, trying to figure out how to put a new link in my chainsaw, Rich was here and said, you need help? I said, yeah. And he said, I always wanted to go fishing, and you know how to fish. I said, yeah.
As Rich and Sonia taught each other survival skills, they discovered they shared a deep love for the land. The two were discussing marriage when Rich's journal, Pining for Sarah, appeared in the pages of Coming into the Country, first published in one of the most famous magazines in America, The New Yorker.
I was thinking, well, this is interesting. We'll see how this ends up. I didn't know at that point if Rich was going to choose to stay with the fisherwoman from Alaska or if he was going to revert to his longing of his heart for Sarah.
Of course, Rich did choose the fishing woman from Alaska, and they've been together ever since. Today, the couple is living on a bluff overlooking Homer, in a cozy log home Rich built himself, on land Sonia's grandparents homesteaded. But the couple is still mourning the way things ended on the Yukon. The area where Rich and Sonia had lived became a national preserve. Coming into the Country documents the federal government handing out trespass notices to wilderness residents. Sonia and Rich had moved off the Yukon by then, but they were close with many people who left. It's not easy for Rich to talk about.
It was uncalled for people that weren't Alaskan to come in here and change this country to their standards without considering the people around the land. And hard to understand when you're a young kid.
Sonia also gets emotional talking about how the Yukon changed when the area became a national preserve. She says it's important to protect the environment, but the people who lived there were important too.
I'm not totally saying that I don't believe in protecting certain areas. I do believe in that. But not everything. Not the entire state.
Rich says young people no longer experience Alaska like he did in 1975. They arrive here with hiking boots, bikes, and skis, and see the state as a kind of picturesque playground. But Rich has a different vision. He says there's no longer a place for a young person with no money to go build a cabin out in the woods.
The young generation, they don't have that right now. And I'd like to see that. I think it makes a better person out of you. You've gained something in your heart, and you're going to love this land more for going out there and doing it.
In the end, McPhee may have publicized Rich's love notes to a girl he didn't end up marrying, but Rich says that's okay because McPhee so perfectly captures his other great love, a time and a place in Alaska that felt truly boundless. For Alaska's Energy Desk, with help from Eric Keto, I'm Elizabeth Harbaugh in Anchorage.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. Tonight's stories can be found at our website, alaskapublic.org. You can also follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Liz Ruskin in Washington, D.C., Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau, Josh Edge, Annie Feit and Elizabeth Harbaugh in Anchorage, Emily Russell in Sitka, Tim Ellis and Dan Bross in Fairbanks, and Tom Bonsey in Ocean Park, Washington. Our audio engineer is Eric Bork. Sean Dugan is our editor and producer. Wesley Early is our web editor. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Northern Air Cargo, providing year-round transportation of all types of freight, from vehicles and oversized equipment to small packages for corporations or small business. Northern Air Cargo, serving Alaska since 1956.
And by
Wells Fargo, with over 13,000 ATMs and more than 6,000 branches coast to coast. For a branch location near you, visit wellsfargo.com.
Alaska's Tobacco Quitline reminds you that 88% of Alaskans don't allow smoking in their homes. A smoke-free environment helps prepare kids for a healthier life and a future free from tobacco. And it makes good economic sense. Secondhand smoke damages property, decreasing its value. Exposure to its toxins leads to disease and increased medical costs. Call 1-800-QUIT-NOW or enroll online at alaskaquitline.com. This message brought to you by Alaska's Tobacco Quitline. Your health matters. Tuesday, January 31st is the last day to enroll in the Health Insurance Marketplace. Information at getcoveredalaska.org or call 1-844-PLANS-AK. This message sponsored by Alaska Primary Care Association.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.